2 meters across. I don't know if you've got a, yes. 1.2 meters across, and it's completely entoured by stones. And the stones are about a meter high, or 3 feet, if you're more comfortable in that measure, about 3 feet high of stones. And then there is alternating layers of leaves. And when I talk about leaves, you're thinking small little Canadian maple leaves. No, I'm talking palm tree leaves. So big leaves at the bottom, and then covered by ash, and then covered by soil, and then more leaves and more ash and more soil, and more leaves and more ash and more soil, till you get to the very top, 3 meters. And what you do then is you plant your garden. But there's a very interesting structure in the center, which is the keyhole. And it is sticks that are pounded into the ground, and they put around other big palm leaves. There we go. Those are palm leaves. And it creates a self-contained composting block. So all the compost that you get during the year, you throw into the center, and the nutrients are then leached out by the roots of the plant, and so you have a self-fertilizing garden. How cool is that? And we're going to do that next year in our keyhole garden plantation out back. All right. So the equivalent space that we have compared to what they have is our 12 boxes would be the equivalent of 3 areas of the keyhole garden. So they're quite big. And the real thing that's really interesting about this project is that it's a total community project. So when we were there, we probably went to, I don't know, 6, 8 keyhole gardens. And all of them were surrounded by a number of workers, a number of kids, a number of families, and so there would probably be 20 people around each one of these keyhole gardens. So we decided that, being North American, we would be doers. And so we went and helped, and about 3 or 4 minutes later, we were graciously given an opportunity to absent ourselves from the helping process because our walls were falling down. And so they sort of moved us aside, showed us some other things, and got us out of the picture. So this was our experience building this particular keyhole garden. Now, where does the keyhole garden process fit in the whole project of Medaguez? Well, food for the hungry. This is a finished garden, so you can't really see the three. This is actually three feet high here, the top looking down on the garden. So we've got some cabbage plants over here. We've got some leek plants. They also grow aubergine eggplant, and they have pepper plants, and this is all for one particular, like one family. So the community builds the garden, but only one family gets to use it. So you go and build another one, and you build another one, and you build another one. So it just is emblematic for me of the kind of unity that was shown in the community when you got together and you worked on a project. Even though you worked on the project together, there was an understanding that this would feed just the one family. Where this fits into our involvement is that anybody who's involved with a sponsored child would have an opportunity to be engaged in this process of having the community help them with creating a keyhole garden. And that goes to the whole philosophy of Food for the Hungry and us, of helping people to improve their livelihoods. And so if you can improve your livelihood by having vegetables on the table, you don't have to buy those vegetables in the market. If you don't have to buy those vegetables in the market, you can use the money you would have used for vegetables for your kids' school fees to schools. And as Les has said, and he's going to talk about education, everything's private there. If you don't have enough money to send your kids to school, your kid doesn't go to school. So this is just one of the ways that we're looking at a project that improves livelihoods, and then that improves the possibility of parents allocating resources to other places than having to do the daily purchase of food in the market. Oh. Part two, forgot about this. Part one was, building the keyhole gardens. Part two is how you grow plants. And so this is the exciting part because you sort of think it's intuitive to grow plants. If anybody's ever started a garden, it's not that intuitive. There are a few tricks you have to learn. So one of the things that FH Canada and FH Haiti works on, and certainly some of our funds as sponsoring children goes to, is the development of regional agricultural schools to teach people how to grow plants successfully. And so once they know how to grow plants successfully, then they can take them and they can plant them in their keyhole garden and have a successful crop. So here is one of the experimental farms. It's probably maybe 20 meters by 20 meters, and it has these amazing plots of leeks and peppers and aubergines and what else? Scotch bonnet peppers. They're really big on these really hot peppers, so those grow really well. And so we were being told about how this works. And this is a very interesting school because it's attached to the new school that's going to be built for kids. And the kids are actually going to be trained how to grow the plants, not just the parents. So this is a brand new exciting development. The school is supposed to open next year, and Danny's going to tell you about that. But this is sort of an integration of the livelihoods piece and the education piece. So it was a very huge encouragement to see how people are starting to think in terms of community and in terms of linking these two education and agriculture projects together.
Okay, so teaching and education is a pretty ingrained profession in our family. You know, I'm married to a teacher, and we have a daughter that teaches in Toronto, but in my life I've also had a grandmother, a great-uncle, a sister, a father-in-law, a sister-in-law, and on Colette's side about several aunts, uncles, and cousins that are all in education. So it wasn't random that I got education to talk about. I'm going to... just tell, that's the summary of what I want to say, just in case I get yanked before my 5 minutes is up. So the education system is very complicated. I was toying with a couple other words, maybe unregulated or chaotic or confusing. And it's really not working very well, but there is some hope in Matagua. You can see I spelt it even different than everybody else. Okay, next slide. So it's complicated. Trying to understand how the education system works is a real challenge. There are government schools, which we understand are very well built. They have certified teachers. They have an approved curriculum and basic supplies and no tuition fees. However, as Don mentioned, there's only about... 20% of the children go to these government schools. The rest have to go to private schools, and private schools charge. There's a tuition fee, and that amount was also a little bit uncertain for me. One of the numbers we got was about $12 a year, which represented quite a significant amount of their, you don't get to go to school. So on the screen here we have, on the bottom right, an example of a government school. You can see it's quite well constructed, and we have one picture of the inside. Maybe doesn't look quite up to North American standards, but it's got desks and a nice blackboard and actually had electric lights. At the top left, there's a private school. This is actually also combines as a community center and a church, and it's run by Pastor Louis. This is in actually Catchimon. And the little inset picture in there is sort of a poor picture of the inside, but you can see it's a multi-purpose building. There's the school benches stacked at the back. There's a wheelbarrow full of peanuts. It's also used for grain storage. And and as I mentioned, it's also a church on Sundays. So there's quite a contrast between the government schools and the private schools. And some of the private schools also consist of just a local entrepreneur setting up a school in their home as a way of getting income. They don't have qualified teachers. They don't have a set curriculum, and so the education that you get is can be it's very varied across what you get. There's just not enough schools, actual buildings to go to. They don't have the funding. The government just hasn't built them. They're full. Okay, the education system is not really working. The literacy rate in Haiti is only 61%. So 64% for males and 50% for females. So only 64% can write. We were told that less than 25% move from elementary school to secondary school, and that only about 1% of Haitians will receive. So, though elementary school is legally compulsory, there's only about 80% even enroll in primary school. So there's 20% that don't even get a start. And we are also told that in the higher regions, Metaguas, some of the higher regions in Metaguas, they just don't even have schools, buildings, so the children can't, just don't go to school, or they're faced with an hour walk. You saw that muddy hill Les showed at the beginning. They have to walk down that and up that each day if they want to get to any kind of a school at all. So why is it not working? There is the lack of schools, as I just mentioned to Marcella. The government schools that are there are full, and the rest of the people have to go to private schools. There's lack of regulation. There's the poverty issue. If you don't have money, you can't pay for private schools. There's unqualified teachers and certainly an inconsistent curriculum. However, next, in Metaguas, there is some hope. We struggled to get some specific numbers for Metaguas, like how many children are there and how many are going to school, what's the literacy rate, but we are certainly made aware that they face the same struggles as generally in Haiti, and that there's just not enough school buildings and a very poor level of teachers. So Food for the Hungry has partnered with the Catholic Church, the Sisters of Mary, and the Sisters of Mary had land, and they have a written agreement that if Food for the Hungry builds a building and supplies school supplies, the Sisters of Mary will not charge for the land and provide teachers. So this building that you see in the back is the beginning of that construction. There's about 10 classrooms, so that could provide schooling for somewhere between 200 and 300 children. They have a expected finish date of July 2018, maybe a bit optimistic. They also have to build a fence around the property before the nuns will come in and teach. So there's a real some encouragement here that there's some progress made that will allow many more children in Metaguas to get a proper education. The Catholic school has a tremendous reputation for providing excellent teachers and good teaching. Another issue is that education is usually taught in French, and most of the children speak Creole at home, so that's a challenge. So let's just pray that the school will get completed and that the children will get a better education that will contribute to a more complete transformation of their lives into a meaningful life.
I was looking at the FH budget for Metaguas for this coming year, and just about 50% of the allocation to Metaguas is going to that school. And I'm also impressed by the fact that, in fact, they've changed their plans for the school a little bit, and they're going to make sure that the roof is proper steel girders and so on, so that it will be hurricane-proof, so it can be used as a hurricane shelter as well. Chris.
So many of you may know that I'm not a plumber, but I'm a plumber's son, and I'll be plugging holes till the plumbing's done. That was the old saying my dad and I had, but I've been involved with my dad way back when I was a kid in plumbing. I work in plumbing wholesale, so I thought it'd be appropriate that I would speak regarding water. So I got three subjects I'm going to kind of cross over from one to the other, and that's water quality, water accessibility, and quantity. I have a reading from Psalm 104, verses 10 to 11. He makes springs pour water into the ravines. It flows between the mountains. They give water to all the beasts of the field. The wild donkeys quench their thirst. So in the first slide, you see this is their water source. You see evidence by just the conditions, some of the conditions we've walked through and the village. It's pretty primitive. And this, by and large, is where they typically would get their water. But if you look at it, it doesn't look really too great to even maybe walk in. You can see that there's obvious contaminants in there. Go to the next slide, Les. You can see people are washing in here. And this was evidenced as we went through the trip, lots of people washing their clothes. So you can imagine what's in there. The water quality is impacted from clothes and dishwashing, bathing, waste disposal, feces and urine from animals and humans. It's absolutely unfit for human consumption, and even cleaning, I would be sketchy. Next one. So here you see we have I call it a mountain water tap. I don't know what you want to call it. It's it's a water tap. It's obviously been installed by the community. And these taps are located to cleaner water sources, which are piped from several hundred meters away. And they're farther up on the mountain, so they're not where that river was. You'd actually have to walk a little bit of a journey. I'll cover that as we go. These piping methods that they use to put these in, they don't allow for the distribution of potable or consumable water. So this water, although it's clean, it's unfit for drinking. The water still must be treated by Western standards. And in my industry, this system would fail to produce clean potable water due to misapplied piping systems. For example, the use of ferrous steel fittings and water penetrable connections. So if you see that pipe that's coming out, that's just a steel pipe. So for instance, if that was here in Canada, we would have a stainless steel or a plastic pipe because they're not going to corrode. So, but this one here is just a steel pipe. So over time it gets rust, and rust attracts bacteria and it harbors bacterial growth. So even in a concealed piping system, you'll still have this. But in my opinion, this is still a subpar option, but it's the best option they have at this moment. So it's better than taking water out of the river. So this here is a view of the trail to the waterhead, and their water sources are limited, and availability is complicated by extreme dry and wet seasons. So the community needs more clean water options, including closer water access. So you're kind of dealing with a wet season and a dry season. So hence, you've got to go, and you can see there's a little hut way up in the top. I believe that was the water source, and then you can see where it has to be piped all the way down and along that trail up to here. So the way they pipe this is they will have sections of pipe which are readily available or easily available, and they connect them, and it's just gravity fed. So this is actually on a hill, but it's lower than where the source is, so you can see where the water will go up, and it'll naturally flow all year long, and it's a fairly consistent water source. So you can see here, this is typical. They will go up, they'll fill their jugs, and they're gonna carry these jugs back, and you can see here, it's manual labor. There's no carts. Well, maybe there is a cart that I'm not, or maybe they use, but generally people are just carrying water. So all of their water has got to come via jugs, and it's got to be manually carried. So it's a lot of work. So there's another photo of people crossing over the river. So picture you're up on the mountain, you're carrying these water jugs, you're going down a slippery trail. If it's in the muddy season, you're walking through muck. You saw the trailer earlier. You know, dry season, maybe not so bad, but it's a lot of work and it's a challenge. And if you picture that, you see the erosion in this river. You can imagine a wet season when that river is full. How are people crossing these rivers? You know, these rivers could be potentially 3 feet, 4 feet, 10 feet deep. You don't know. On this slide here, you can see the erosion. So actually, Carissa, our leader, she was chastising me quite well because I was standing on that route, and she's just like, "Chris, I'm not comfortable with this." Of course, me, I'm oblivious. But you can see that this route is the only thing that's holding that riverbank or that trail from completely collapsing into the river. And when this road erodes further, so we're kind of drifting into another subject here, it'll cut off water access to, I think it was 200 families, I believe it was, and there's a need to fortify the riverbanks with stones and retaining walls. And what was the name of that? Gabions. Yeah, they call them gabions. I don't know if you guys have seen along a river. I don't think I had a picture of it. It's basically piles of rocks held with a wire mesh, and they build it along the banks, and it'll just, you know, prevent the, you know, at least you have stones and something firm for the water not to to wash away. So you see some challenges with just obtaining water. Okay, you can go to the next one. This here is a picture. We're back up at the hill, but you look at the soil. It's very clay. It's basically clay-based. So when it's wet, you're sticking in there. I mean, a few times I thought we're going to lose Ron. You know, he was feet stuck in there. And then when it dries out, it's just like concrete. So when you get heavy rains in the wet season, you can imagine the water is just hitting that and running off of it, and it just compounds the effects of you can't hold water in the ground naturally, and when it comes down, it just flows into the rivers and creates pretty dangerous conditions. So in summary, water supply is a top three priority of the community. As an example, our group had to consume bottled water even for brushing our teeth. Bottled water, I observe this, is a wasteful and not feasible option for the community. We had to be reminded by FH staff to stay hydrated in the hot weather. Complicating our situation was the non-existence of washroom facilities and places in the community to wash our hands. So you really, and we were treated very well. I mean, we had showers, but even I'm in the shower and, you know, your mouth is open, and you have to really pay attention to what you're doing. So that's us for us to be blessed enough to be in a shower. You can imagine what these people are going through. You can go to the next one. So the solutions I see, like this one, it's a water treatment station. And technologies such as filtration or reverse osmosis, and reverse osmosis is just a process of bringing water through membranes and filters, and it'll pull out the impurities. They can treat water at the source or in the community. These are costly and complex to build and maintain. More wells as another option, sanitary water piping and handling systems, and locations closer to the community. They have high initial costs but are much simpler to maintain and reliable. So going back to what we saw with the well up in the mountain, I think they can improve some of the methods and how they do it, but at this point, we'll take it. You can go to the last one, Les. Another real low-cost option for just using water is this little tippy tap, and you can see where the foot, it goes on a stick, and the stick actually tips over the pot, and you can wash your hands. That, in my opinion, is actually cleaner than a tap, because you think of a tap, you've got to touch, unless you have an electronic faucet, you've got to touch the handles on the tap, so you're getting contamination. So, in summary, you see some of the water challenges. Water is a big, big deal. And when we talked to the CDC, they acknowledged we need water. And when we touched on the plans about how to get water there, we had some blank stares. There's obviously some big challenges. So anyway, that's my piece on water. If you guys have any questions, I'd be happy to ask them after the service.
As I said, Hannah and Ron are away, so let's hear from them.
Imagine, if you will, trying to cover all of your annual medical costs with a single tooth. You probably scoff at the idea, thinking, that's not nearly enough. And you're right, but it is the reality for the average person in Haiti. The 2017-2018 budget designated 5 billion goods for the health sector, that's about $125 million Canadian. And if the entirety of that went directly to providing healthcare, it seems like a semi-reasonable amount. But 80% of the budget goes to infrastructure and administrative costs, which only leaves about $2 per person per year. Even if money wasn't an issue for the average family, it's hard to get to a hospital or a doctor to access medical care. And even when you get there, it might not be the greatest systems or the greatest technology, leaving many people who can afford to heading into the DR just to get their medical care looked after. The average person just can't afford it. And that's why your best bet is just not to get sick, which is actually where FH seeks to step in. Their training, many of their projects, have a side effect of helping the healthcare system. But the LEAD Mothers program is specifically designed for health promotion and prevention of preventable diseases. A minimum of one health agent per community goes out and trains 10 mothers about basic sanitation like tippy taps for hand washing stations and basic nutrition. Those 10 mothers then get to go out and train 10 others, creating a cascade effect. And the training that the mothers receive is about basic nutrition and preventing the spread of germs so that their families have a better baseline health from which to start. It's not a perfect solution, but it's a start. And that's where FH works, in giving a start of hope.
In each community, there's a board of leaders, influential people in the community who call the Community Development Council or Community Development Committee, which pulls together and determines what the priorities are for the community. And Ron's going to talk about those, and particularly the Ketchum one.
This is Haiti. This is Haiti. This is Haiti. And this is Haiti. A land, a nation of contrasts. And our trip revealed two very distinct yet contrasting communities, side by side in the commune of Belle Adere. For more than a decade, FH has partnered with Ketchumon. It is drawing to a close and very close to its graduation. Next door is Mattagwas, where FH, Pine Grove, and two corporate sponsors have partnered for a little over 2 years. So while our initiative is focused on Mattagwas, we spent more time examining the programs and processes at Ketchumon. This gives us a chance to see successful endeavors and some pitfalls and stumbling blocks to a successful graduation. We saw in Ketchumon a cleaner, more organized community. We saw agricultural and infrastructure development. We witnessed a successful savings and loan group, and we visited some vibrant churches. In what had once been an enclave for voodoo, some 40% now profess faith in Jesus Christ. Yet challenges remain. The Community Development Committee struggles with issues of control and selfishness. It has not mastered the goal of looking outward to serve other communities. This is not surprising, given the country's psyche, where jealousy and a distrust of leadership are deeply etched. As we walk with Mattagwas through the process of transformation, we see a Community Development Committee that struggles to move from a wish list of improvements to a coherent vision and plan for their community. We must pray for the development of these leaders and trust that the Lord will transform their hearts so there will be a passion to help their neighbors. We need to pray that visual and physical improvements are not the only results we see when, with God's help, Mattagwas reaches her graduation.
Probably one of the most emotional parts of the trip was the times we had to visit with some of the sponsored children. Jeremy, you want to come and talk about that?
Good morning, Pine Grove. I want to thank you for your prayers because our mission went so well, and we believe prayer must be behind this mission. I have to start by reading a verse we have in Matthew 25:35, where we read, "For I was hungry, and you fed me. I was thirsty, and you gave me a drink. I was a stranger, and you invited me to your home. I was naked, and you gave me clothing. I was sick, and you cared for me. I was in prison, and you visited me." As you know, one of the main objectives of our mission to Haiti was to visit these children we sponsor there. We visited, I believe, 14 on the total of 18, so we missed three or four of them. So I would say the mission is accomplished. How that happened? Just before we get there, this field staff, the staff in Haiti, they schedule all the visit, and they did that very wisely. We don't have to walk into the backyard and where we cannot go. They put it in order so we can go this house and this house. We didn't do the same, not one the same day, but day one, day two, day three, and at the end of our mission, we could visit almost of the children. And the children there, very bright, good children. You know, we would say they are shy. Here in Canada, you would see a 4-year-old child, and he look at an adult in your eyes, and he tell you any question you want to ask. But there, the children, they are very shy. They reply to your question, yes or no. And you have to dig in order if you want to have more answers. And this is why Don and Ron and Les did when they say, how love you? You know, and you have good translators because the staff in the Food for the Hungry staff, they are very, very skilled, very bright. They could do translation. So I didn't even use to use my Creole there because they were so good. So the children, they are very happy to see they have friends in Canada. They have big dreams. Even the 6-year-old, when you ask, what do you want to become? Some of them say, I want to build house when I become older. Or I want to be a teacher. Very bright. But as you know, the condition is not that easy there. We see the houses. And you can see Don questioning these children, getting into a very conversational with them. And on my right is Jean-Marie with some children. And on top again, you see Don and Les and Danny. And this is very, very interesting moment we have with the children. Now what happened is our presence in Kachima and Metaguas in whole Belader make Food for the Hungry more visible. Many people want to be part of the program of Food for the Hungry. But how you can imagine, Food for the Hungry has a limited budget. And I believe this is a necessity for anyone to pray so the situation can improve and there can be more help for the children. We are very blessed to be able to see how it's going. It was not easy because, as you say, the road is not that good. But we had a good week, and we thank Lord for this nice project, for this nice visit that Chris with his friends. You see, very bright children. And it was a privilege for us to see them face to face. Thank you very much.
Yeah, that little girl was a firecracker, that one. We visited children who were sponsored by each of us individually, but we also visited a lot of the children, like this little girl, who was sponsored by the church, not by an individual in the church. And so that was special. And I'll put up a presentation for the children later on to give them at Sunday school about the kids that the church supports. And the notes we took there. So just to finish up, I just want to outline a couple of things about child support. One of the things that was never really clear to me was, you know, we have this model in FH where, yeah, the church does some partnership funding with FH Canada, but most of the support comes through individuals, you, myself, where we sponsor a child. But that money goes to the community. Through FH Canada distributes that through FH Haiti, and it goes to the community to help the community out. So what is the benefit to the children that you sponsor? There are several. First of all, the children who are sponsored are prioritized, and so they get priority access to school materials and school fees. So FH will help with the school fees. If a family of a sponsored child can't get there, they'll help support with that, or to buy the uniform, or to buy school supplies. So the children that you sponsor get priority for that. They also can get special hospital care, and I want to be, so this is outside the normal sponsorship, but sometimes you'll find, and we had one case there, where there was a child who obviously needed, in this case, surgery. And turns out the child wasn't actually enrolled with FH Canada because lived up on the mountain, and A, was too young, and B, lived up on the mountain, and so wasn't enrolled in school. But we're working on getting that child, they're working on getting that child registered with FH Canada. But that child needs an operation. And so what FH does, they will raise some special funds from partners and so on to pay for the operation and the care for that child to make sure that they get the additional care that they need. It's not a normal situation, but it happens sometimes. Their families are also prioritized for livestock, if that's appropriate. Depending upon what their location is, it may be livestock they need, or they may need some money to help fund a business. So buying and reselling. We met a lady who was buying and reselling bottled water and pop and things like that. And like all business people, you know, they've got so much tied up in operations, but they need some money to be tied up in inventory. And in Canada, you would go to the bank. There, you don't want to go to the bank. It's a really bad situation. That's another whole topic. So, but the small amounts of money to help fund their inventory can be helped with through your sponsorship. And again, their parents, in turn, are prioritized for training, whether it's training as a farmer, whether it's training as a lead mother, training in health education, and so on. So the children are all that you support are prioritized for that. Now, we did our push a couple of years ago we sponsor about 41, 42 children from Pine Grove. Right now, the cost is $38 a month. If you've joined Pine Grove in the last few years and you'd like to sponsor a child, you hear about this and you think this is something that as part of Pine Grove I'd like to participate in, you can just go to the FH Canada website. There's a link there that's at the top that says sponsor a child. There's a drop-down list. You scroll down the page, there's a drop-down list right there that you select Haiti. And it will give you a whole bunch of children on Haiti. You can read about them and choose a child to sponsor and register online that way. If you do that, just let them know in the notes that you're with Pine Grove Church and let us know so we can connect it up so that we can help track them as well. But that's an opportunity for those of you who may be feeling left out because you didn't get a chance to sponsor. We can arrange help. You can arrange your sponsorships. One of the other groups that we saw there, we saw a savings group in action. These are fascinating. I said going to banks for money is not a very good option because they charge higher interest rates and They're very nasty about getting the money back. So what they do in is they put together a group. This one was about 14 or 15 people. They'll put the group of people, and it's sort of a savings bank and everything all combined. So what they do is they can buy units of ownership in the savings group. Savings group lasts for 1 year, and they buy so many shares. And there's a limit in their constitution for how many shares you can buy, so one person can't get control of it. And so they buy their shares, and they can further deposit and buy further shares each month. So it becomes a savings bank. You'll see at the top there, there's a box, a wooden box there. The money is held in a box, and there are three padlocks on it. One, two, three. So one person keeps the box. Three other people keep the keys. Okay? And so it takes three people to unlock it and one person to bring it there. And they meet each month. And they can, as well as depositing, they can also borrow. And the savings group decides whether, you know, somebody says, I want to borrow so much money for a business, or I want to borrow so much money to help pay because I'm short of cash right now. I want to pay for my children's school fees or their school uniforms. And the committee, the group of them will decide, yes, we'll support that, no, we won't. You can borrow up to three times the amount of your deposits, and the loan is at 5%, but that's 5% total cost for the loan. It has to be paid back within the year, and you have to pay back each month a part of it. So they're getting a better rate. They're getting approval of their friends, so there's some watching over. And these people, if Don borrows money from Don and I are in the same group, and Don borrows $50 from it, and you know, it's in my interest that he is successful so that we get our money back, and so there's a strong sense of community and trust with each other that's built through this, and that trust is a very important factor. When you go to, they have to go to a meeting each month. Everybody has to attend. If you miss a meeting or you're late for a meeting, you pay a penalty. And actually, the interesting thing was their return on investment, so their return on their funds for the year, the group we were looking at, was just around 6%. Okay, that's better than we're doing here. They borrow at 5%, which is better than we get here, and they're getting 6% back on their money. Pretty good deal. But it's all short term, and it's all, in our terms, it would be a fairly small amount, but it's significant because it builds trust, builds cooperation, and helps them proceed forward. So just to wrap up a couple more points here, Madagascar, the community where the children we sponsor are, we asked their development committee, what are your three top priorities? Number one was water access for the Pilamat area. So the Pilamat area was up on the mountain, and some of it was down lower down by the river, but all up that side of the valley. And the water access is really a problem. Like when we saw it, it's lush and green and looked lovely, and the slopes were slippery, but then the dry season comes. And you don't think about Haiti that way. At least I didn't think about it that way. I thought about it being lush and green and lots of water, and there is water up in them there are hills, but it was hard getting it down, and it's hard to access. Most of the children, if any of you are sponsoring children, and you look, what chores do? They gather water. They come home from school. They put a 3-gallon pail on their heads. They walk, you know, half a kilometer, kilometer and a half, 2 kilometers, fill it with water, and bring it back home again. That's their daily chores every single day. So, water access. Riverbank erosion. You saw that riverbank erosion? There are houses just right on the edge of that. You know, they're going to fall into that ravine really soon if something isn't done. So, and it's endangering 200 families in that area. So that's their number two priority. And their number three priority was road access to the new school. They're assuming that the new school is going to get finished, which it will eventually. But the road was again, okay, let me see. There we go. There's the erosion. There's the road to the new school. Okay? That's the way you get in. There is no way. You can drive a motorcycle down there, motocross motorcycles only. You have a little river at the bottom to ford, so you need a bridge to cover that. But that's the road in. These teachers are going to have to get in probably by car each day. Students have to get in. You want a better access to that. So those were their three priorities for Madagascar. So Ketchuman will likely graduate in about 2 years. Madagascar will likely graduate in about 10 years. That's a little bit longer. Food for the Hungry expects 10 years to graduation. I think realistically in Haiti, we're looking at 12 to 13 years. We will continue to walk with Madagascar until graduation as Pine Grove. And we need to continue to pray for them. We need to continue to support them. Knowing that that probably this is one of the toughest areas in the world to try and bring about this transformation. There is so much ingrained poverty, disregard for your fellows, so much selfishness. It's a very, very difficult area in the world to work. Our next trip to Haiti is estimated to be in February, maybe March, but anyways, sometime around that in 2019. So you can start thinking and praying about that. And we'll let you know in future about any other future mission trips to other places. Thank you very much for hearing us this morning. I know we're a little bit over time, but I think it was worthwhile.